All right, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Justin Senior, and I am the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid here at the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and we're going to get the Medical Care Advisory Committee meeting underway. I think it's just after 2 o'clock, and it looks like we do have a quorum, so if you could please call the roll. Carla.
Yes. Cheryl Young, Department of Health.
Present.
Jennifer Lang, DCF.
Here.
Madeline Nobles, Elder Affairs.
Here.
Crystal Stickle.
Here.
Amy Guinan.
Bonnie Kuhn. Here.
Dr. Moffitt.
Here.
Dr. Thacker.
Here.
Dr. Payne.
Here.
Stan Whitaker.
Here.
Martha.
Here.
Martha Pierce.
And on here.
Thank you. And on the phone, I believe we have Michael Lockwood. Tracy Inman, Iris Wimbush, Sarah Sequencia. The phones are muted at this time. There's an operator-assisted call, so those on the phone are not able to answer.
All right. Well, we're here to talk about a physician incentive payment program that the agency is rolling out, and we wanted to seek some public commentary on that particular program. But before we do, I just have a couple of welcomes. First off, Cheryl Young from the Department of Health. You're new to the committee. Welcome aboard. Madeline Nobles from the Department of Elder Affairs, also new to the committee. Welcome aboard. And Crystal Stickle from the Florida Hospital Association. Welcome aboard. Bonnie, you're also new. Welcome to the Medical Care Advisory Committee from Florida Legal Services. And I also wanted to say one other thing. I believe Jennifer Lang has somehow been permitted to retire or to leave state employment. Unbelievably, I can't imagine without you. You do such a fantastic job. Thank you for all that you do. We are definitely going to miss you. Jenny Lang from the Department of Children and Families. So. You've done a great job. You've been such wonderful to work with. So thank you for all that you've done. Moving on, I have a presentation here. And going to talk with you a little bit about a program that our agency is rolling out in conjunction with the health plans and in accordance with the Florida statutes, as well as in accordance with a resolution that we've reached with the Florida Pediatric Society. First off, I want to let everybody know, and before I get started, that there is a sign-in sheet as you come in, and if you want to sign in and include an email address, we will add you to our statewide Medicaid Managed Care Interested Parties list. And the purpose of this meeting and the purpose of this presentation is to obtain public comment regarding the Managed Medical Assistance, what we call our Physician Compensation Program, which we are implementing pursuant to Florida law. The specific site on that for the lawyers is Section 409.967 of the Florida statutes. Right now, what we'd like to do is get some public input, and really what we have today is going to be a listening session. I'm going to give a brief presentation regarding the Physician Compensation Program, and then we're going to open the floor to public comment. When you sign in, you should have had an opportunity to state whether you'd like to speak during the public comment period. If you did not sign in there, we certainly will give an opportunity for people in the room to give public comment and to hear their comments and their thoughts on the program. But first come, first serve will be the people who have signed in and indicated that they'd like to speak. For people joining us on the phone, we have an operator-assisted call, and at the end of the presentation, the operator is going to ask whether any phone participants wish to make public comments. And we're going to do it in the following order. First, we're going to take public comments from people here in the audience in Tallahassee. Then we're going to ask for public comment from the people on the phone around the state. And then finally, we are going to ask for comments from the members seated here at the table who are on the Medical Care Advisory Committee for their input into the plan. In addition to being able to make verbal comments here, if you're a shy type, And I can't imagine there are any of those in the room, but if you were, you are allowed to give written comments to us. There's a comment form near the entrance, and you can submit comments in writing, and you can do that either here today or through email or physical email, and it has all the information on the form as to what addresses you need to send it to, whether it's a physical mailing address or whether it's a virtual address. And we certainly do encourage anyone that has an opinion on the program or would like to put some input into the program to make a comment either here in person or in writing over the next few days. All right. As you see on the screen, Florida law directs the Agency for Healthcare Administration to implement and operate a statewide Medicaid managed care program, which we did, and we rolled the program out long-term care first and then managed medical assistance in calendar years 2013 and 2014. As a general rule around the state, most Medicaid recipients, the overwhelming percentage of Medicaid recipients, particularly those who receive their medical assistance services from the state, receive them through health plans that are under contract with the agency. The state is divided into 11 regions. As a general rule, there are about four or five health plans for people to choose from in each region of the state. Sometimes it's a little lower than that. Sometimes it's a little higher, but that's the average. And the plans themselves are the ones that enter into contracts and build networks with providers and have the ability to set the rates and the payment, whether it's a fee schedule or an alternative payment arrangement. They enter into contractual arrangements with their providers, and they can dictate the rates or negotiate the rates, rather, that they pay with their providers and how they pay providers. But that being said, there is a statutory provision in Florida law in the statewide Medicaid managed care statute that calls for the plans in the medical assistance side of the program to coordinate care and manage chronic disease and to achieve savings through that, and to drive these savings and redirect the savings into increased compensation for physicians, with it seeking to try to get physicians to the equivalent of the Medicare rate. And the agency is allowed, it says that we may, in the statute, impose fines or other sanctions on a plan that doesn't meet this performance standard after 2 years of continuous operation. The statewide Medicaid managed care statute called for us to implement managed medical assistance on or before October 1st of 2014. We actually beat that deadline, but we're going to regard October 1st of 2016 as the beginning of the third year of operations. And so that is when we're going to start enforcing this statute. And what I'm going to describe to you is how we're going to start the enforcement and implementation of this particular provision. All right. Health plans are going to be required to pay, to create and pay through an incentive program, payments out of savings that they achieve from efficiencies through care coordination. There are a lot of different ways that managed care plans can save money, but the ones that we really, really favor and the ones that we want them to use are the idea of coordinating the care and getting patients the services that they need in the right setting, with the right service at the right time, so that they avoid and head off more expensive interventions at a later date. They also can coordinate care and avoid duplication. They can, with some providers, offer volume in exchange for discounts, and they can get into very advanced and sophisticated fraud-fighting techniques like electronic visit verification and data mining and stuff like that. Those are the types of things we want them to do. The savings that they achieve in our program then can be driven into physician compensation going forward. So that is what we're looking for. As we've thought about the program, we have done our best, and I will get, as I get into the slides, there are slides on what our schedule is, and I'll keep everybody apprised of when this is going to occur. But we did not want to dictate to the plans exactly how they did their incentive programs. Plans already have a variety of different incentive structures that they use with providers and have contracts set up that already do provide incentives, and we didn't want to step on that, and we didn't want to dictate the way an incentive program would work so that we stifled innovation, because we do want the plans to be creative and think creatively about how to better compensate the physicians and other providers that are in their program, and we didn't want to have a government agency dictating how they would do that. So there are two types because of that, of physician incentive payment programs. The first is one that we're going to propose. We are going to develop the parameters around how this program works and how physicians would earn the incentive. And plans can choose our alternative, what we call our alternative incentive program. The other is that the plan itself can come up with an incentive program using, they can build on things that they've already developed in terms of incentive structures, enhance them or use them if they're already paying the Medicare rate. And if they're going to do that, though, they need to tell us exactly what they're doing, get their plan into us so that we can look at, we can assess its size and its scope, make sure that it gives providers, and you'll see this term used later on, gives the providers that we identify a reasonable opportunity to earn the Medicare equivalent. And we'll be approving those plans. And again, I'll talk about the schedule a little bit more later on in the presentation. Now, the identified providers, when we're talking about this program, whether it's our program or whether it's something that the health plan comes up with on its own, identified providers are the providers that are eligible to qualify for the Physician Incentive Program payments. And these identified providers are required to have a reasonable opportunity to earn the MMA Physician Incentive Program payment, which is payment at the Medicare rate. We are gunning here for the breadth of the program to make sure that the when we say the providers have a reasonable opportunity to earn, we're looking to make sure that a decent percentage of the providers in the plan are going to be earning this at the initial state, and that it's a reasonable opportunity also for more providers to come on board over time and to earn the increased reimbursement rates. Reasonable opportunity, and where this comes from, is the idea that a lot of different payers are coming from in terms of Medicare or going to, in terms of Medicare, in terms of in the commercial space, which is the idea that we want to really get toward a situation where we are paying for value and we are paying for performance as opposed to simply paying for volume. So the providers, what we're hoping to do is develop a setup where the providers that are really doing an outstanding job for their patients are the ones that are going to receive significantly enhanced payments as a result of that and be rewarded for their efforts. Now, this particular slide, it's important to look at these slides and understand what AP program means or what IHP program means. The AP program is our alternative proposal at the agency. If a plan were to choose to use our alternative program, then this would apply to them. First thing is, this particular program is going to be geared in its initial iteration toward board-certified pediatricians and board-certified OBGYNs. And we chose those two groups for a very specific reason, and you can see it here in the first bullet, which is that we serve, of the 3.2 million people that are in the MMA program, about 2.3 million of them are children. So children and the care for children is really of primary importance in our program. The other is that we cover 136,000 births. That's an annual figure that is generally going up over time. That is more than half of the births in the state of Florida in any given year. So we have a very outsized importance in the birth process in the state. And that's why we wanted to identify providers that had, in our estimation, real significance and importance in our program. Now, If a plan is to come up with its own program, they must also direct that program toward board-certified pediatricians and board-certified OBGYNs. They are, however, allowed in their proposal, and we will look at it and potentially approve it, they are allowed to include other primary care physicians that provide services to children. So we would definitely listen and look and see if they've identified any other physician groups that provide primary care services to children, and potentially they could be added into a plan-specific initiative. And we have to wait and see what the plans come up with in that regard. Back to our program. We do exclude certain providers, even if they would otherwise be an identified provider, from participation in the program. In particular, if you look at federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics, and others, it's important to note that they get paid differently than other providers. There's an encounter rate that goes to those entities when they see a patient. That encounter rate is actually quite high, and so physicians and other practitioners that work in those settings get what we would regard as significantly higher than the equivalent of the Medicaid fee schedule and would already get something fairly comparable potentially to what Medicare pays. And so those provider types are not going to be included in it. They're going to be paid their normal, very high encounter rate. It also does not apply to non-participating providers. For a health plan-specific program, There are the same excluded provider types. The plans, however, are also allowed to identify other potential excluded providers in their plan and to give us a rationale and explanation for why those providers should or could be excluded. And it may be that there are certain providers in certain areas of the state that are already getting very high rates or something like that where a plan could justify that they shouldn't participate in this program. So we wait and see what the plans have in store for us in terms of an explanation as to why they would exclude other providers, but they can. Okay. For both us and for the plans, an identified provider who has met all of the requirements to receive the physician incentive program payment is called a qualified provider. And in our program, a qualified provider, and I'm going to speak first about, a qualified provider is someone who's going to receive the enhanced payment from the health plan, and it is any board-certified pediatrician or board-certified OBGYN whose practice has been recognized by one of the following organizations as a patient-centered medical home. So what we're looking for is accreditation as a patient-centered medical home. You can get an accreditation from the Association for Ambulatory Healthcare or the Accreditation Association for Ambulatory Healthcare, which is AAAHC. They could get NCQA Level 2 accreditation, or they could be accredited as a person-centered medical home by the Joint Commission. We didn't want to choose. There are lots of different accrediting agencies for person-centered medical homes, and we didn't want to choose winners and losers. So those are the levels that we looked at. Level 2 with NCQA roughly seems to translate to Joint Commission or AAAHC accreditation, and so that's why we chose that. It's a real balance here as we've started to really dive into the weeds of this program and try to figure out how we should implement it and how we should deliver this. It's really important that any criteria that we develop for earning the incentive payment actually tie back to savings from a plan's perspective, because if the providers that are getting the bump aren't really doing things that are associated with savings, you create a potential perverse incentive, which is that providers that are supposedly doing what we think is a great job are earning a ton of money, but the plans themselves would want to steer patients to other providers that are lower cost, and it kind of defeats the purpose of the program. And there is some literature out there now, it's developing, that is showing that patient-centered medical homes do save money and that it is something that is associated with savings. And hopefully it's associated with enough savings that it would not interfere or make the plans want to steer patients to other providers. And we certainly talked about those criteria, frankly, with the health plans as well as with certain pediatric groups around the state to get their thinking on it before we went ahead and chose that measure. Okay. Still continuing on with our program, when it comes to a board-certified OBGYN, we are looking for quality here, and we're looking for the OBGYNs who achieve certain HEDIS scores with respect to the frequency of ongoing prenatal care, postpartum care, as well as their C-section rate. And just to point out the C-section rate, and certainly these criteria are strongly associated with saving money. The C-section rate, 35%, that number is where we're setting it right now. We may drop that over time because we do have a goal of a C-section rate that is lower than 35% in the state. That is slightly below our current statewide average for the Medicaid program, so we are hoping for improvement right out of the gate. It's important to know also, I think, that in the Medicaid program, we actually do better than the private sector when it comes to the C-section rate. So outside of Medicaid, the C-section rate is quite a bit higher, frankly, than Medicaid. But we are committed to trying to keep that rate down and to keep driving for significant reductions. Now, for plan-specific proposals, they are allowed to vary the method by which the identified providers qualify for the enhanced payment. They don't have to use the same qualifications that we do, but their provider qualifications must be approved by the agency, and I'll go through the schedule that we're going to use for them to submit their plans and for us to approve them a little bit later on in the presentation. In terms of payment, this is another area where we don't want to be too prescriptive when it comes to dealing with the plans. Plans have a lot of different methods that they use, some things already in place in terms of rewarding providers. Some might be just increasing the provider's rate to the straight Medicare fee-for-service fee schedule. Others might be paying them on the Medicaid fee-for-service fee schedule, but paying them a per member per month. If they achieve certain quality measures, maybe they get an additional $5 or $7 or $10 per member per month for all of the patients that they see that actually ends up crosswalking to the rough equivalent of the Medicare rate. Another is they could pay a subcapitation arrangement to the physician's office that ultimately would be increased, and that subcapitation rate would it be the equivalent of the Medicare rate. We've dealt with all of these things before in our analytics because we had to implement the physician fee increase under the Affordable Care Act, and a lot of the payment arrangements around the state between pediatricians in particular and the managed care plans were not done on a fee-for-service basis. So we have crosswalked these things before and have some experience with it, and we'll be using our actuaries to do it. The incentive payments are going to be for effective dates of service beginning October 1st, 2016. You don't start as a physician trying to earn the bump on October 1st, 2016 and find out you earned it later. You are supposed to get, for the services you are rendering, you're supposed to earn it starting on October 1st, 2016 if you are a qualified provider. And you'll see here as I go through the timeline, one important thing to note, I'll skip ahead to the fourth bullet, is that the criteria that the plans come up with, or in our proposal, the idea that you're a person-centered medical home, over time, more practices could become person-centered medical homes, and they would qualify for the bump. So the physicians that qualify for the bump, that list has to be updated every 6 months. And we do want a list, and you'll see here on September 1st, 2016, the first bullet is we want a list of the providers that the plan has under contract that have earned the bump and that will start getting paid the bump on October 1st of 2016. That is significantly easier for us to enforce from an enforcement perspective and a contract enforcement perspective. If we know and the providers know whether they've earned the bump or not and whether they can expect it for the subsequent 6 months, and then we'll get a new list 6 months later. Maybe a provider has lost their accreditation. Maybe some providers have picked it up. The list might change a little bit. But all the providers should know, and we should know, whether they've earned the bump or not, and there shouldn't be any disputes in the middle of November about whether or not a provider is entitled to the bump or not. And there is the timeline for you. They could propose changes annually. We also might update our incentive program. In particular, the thing that we might update would be that 35% on the C-section rate. We might start slowly ratcheting that downward to keep everyone ahead of the state average and slowly get it down into the 20s or quickly get it down in the 20s, as the case may be. But here you have the timeline. And with that, there's some additional information that people can go online and get to. And I will now open it up for public comment, and we will begin. We're going to begin, Stan, with the people in the room. Anybody who has signed public comment cards, we can start.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to start with the individuals in the room who signed up to comment, and then we will go to the phones, and then we will take the members of the committee. So. I'm first going to start with Jared Fowler of the Florida Medical Association. And we'll need to get him a microphone. If you could step up to the podium over here.
Sure.
Jeff, are you going to speak for the association? Okay. So this is Jeff Scott from the Florida Medical Association.
Go ahead. First, Justin, thank you for letting us come and have a present opportunity to speak. I got a question first, so that perhaps.
Okay.
So perhaps we can make this a little bit shorter. We have a whole host of questions about how this program is going to operate, and I'm assuming that I can submit these questions in writing, and that we'll have an opportunity to ask follow-up questions based on your responses. And if that's the case, then I won't go through question by question we have, and I'll just simply use my time making a few comments. First, you know, the FMA was intimately involved in the drafting of this legislation. And we certainly intended that the increased compensation would be for all physicians, not just a subset of physicians or board-certified physicians, but for all physicians, both primary care and specialists who participated in the Medicaid program. And it certainly wouldn't be restricted to just those who jumped through certain hoops that were created by either ACA or the insurance companies. And so from that standpoint, we have quite a few concerns about how this program will operate and the limited nature of the physician population that it's going to apply to. Again, I'll get into questions that I have about exactly how and who this is going to operate for, but first I wanted to register the FMA's concerns about the limited nature and about the fact that they have to, quote, earn this compensation. To me, those additional hoops and arbitrary qualifications or actions that physicians are going to have to accomplish, to me, is unwarranted, and we have significant concerns about how that's going to operate. For us, you know, when we envisioned how this plan was going to be structured, we had a lot of conversations among specialists about how, after the 2 years expired, whether rates would increase to Medicare levels or not. And I didn't believe for a minute that they would. We had some that felt that it would be all specialists, and it's come to pass that apparently it's not going to be all physicians. And as I said, we have a significant concern about that. If the savings that are to be generated by the program are not sufficient to pay all physicians at Medicare levels, we'd like to know why. Why has the program not generated those savings? And if, based on those answers, if those answers don't aren't acceptable, then we would like to go back to the legislature, declare the program a failure, and say let's start over. So, you know, those are the concerns we have. Again, we have a lot of questions that we'd like some answers to, and we'll be providing those in writing. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Was Mr. Fowler going to speak also for FMA, or is that the overall FMA response? Okay. We did have a couple of other people who indicated that they may wish to speak that are in the room. Those are Tony Large.
Not now. Tony Large, I represent the Florida College of Emergency Physicians as well as the Florida Orthopedic Society and the Florida Society of Rheumatologists. Thank you for having us here today. We've had meetings previously with you on this issue, both Justin and Beth. I think we're most surprised that there has been a reversal in the proposal as it's moved forward. As Jeff said, I was very encouraged every time we sat down with a meeting with y'all since the implementation, or I shouldn't say the implementation, but the passage of the legislation. Every time it was said to us that it was the plan to keep the focus on what the legislation, or the legislators when they passed the bill said. And that was physicians across our state that treat Medicaid patients were giving up a lot as we enacted a managed care system. In return for that, we were going to get the Medicare rate. And that also was based on the managed care company saying that with the fraud and abuse initiatives that they could enact, that ACA could not, under its existing fee-for-service, those dollars would be redirected specifically to the physicians that actually provide care to those Medicaid patients day in and day out. On behalf of our colleagues that will get the fee increase, we are encouraged for them. They are a great access point for primary care. I think what this proposal, and my clients feel this way as well, has lost focus on the cost shifts that occur to specialists across our state. Kind of missing the point of the enactment of the legislation, I think, is the one thing that they would really want ACA to get the point. As I said, it was designed to increase access to care by increasing payments to provide to those physicians providing care to Medicaid recipients, and the key word is access. And what we're seeing way too often is the access point hopefully can be handled by the primary care physician, the pediatrician, but all too often they're coming to our emergency rooms. That is their access point to not only urgent care, but for specialty care, they're out. We also, when the legislation was enacted, really assume this would apply to all specialists, and the idea being they're not getting access in the community via networks, so the idea is that by increasing the rate to the Medicare rate, more physicians would become members of the plan. Now, in fact, what you've done is further incentivize Medicaid patients to be sent to the ER, and for that poor ER doctor, and I'll tell you, if anyone hasn't visited an ER recently, they spend hours on the phone looking for specialty physicians to take these patients. And the rates that they get reimbursed for Medicaid are not sufficient to cover this additional administrative burden. I agree when the term earn these incentive dollars were used. I'm sure my physicians would be appalled for you to think that they are not earning their dollars every day plus when they treat Medicaid patients. It is a unique population and one that brings its own struggles with it for the physicians that are treating those patients. And in many cases, they want more for that patient than they're getting in the current system. And this was the one glimmer of hope that they thought would increase access by increasing that payment for all physicians, not just the ones that are listed in this proposal. And saying that, I don't think you can look at this proposal alone. I think you need to couple it with the other rules that ACA has recently noticed and or other notifications that we've received. One such is the copay increase for all physicians providing care. It was noticed, and so it's going to go up $2 per visit is what we saw from the rule, and if that's not the intentions of Medicaid, please let us know, but that's how it's listed. It says physician services and ARNP services, and then it also goes down to talk about emergency room services and a percentage of the overall care is how we read the rule. On top of that, we got the notification.
Let me just respond to that just to get that off the table. There's no change to the copayments. Copayments are what they always were. Almost every managed care plan has waived copayments entirely. That is just a rearranging of the rules as part of our overall overhaul of that. So please, I just want to get that clear right off. There are no changes to copayments. Yeah.
Well, that's encouraging because previously, especially for emergency care, which are many of the specialists I'm talking about, whether you're an orthopedic surgeon or emergency physician, that had only applied to the facility charge. But the way it looked as if from here on out. And that's what's alarming, too. If the rule says one thing, even though the managed care companies are waiving it, we'd prefer that to be stated in the rule for safeguards from here on out. Okay, that's good to hear about. Thank you. Another thing is the publication that we received from Magellan saying that emergency care will not be covered unless it's prior auth. And what that said was that either the pediatrician or the primary care doctor had to refer the patient to the ER or that Magellan had to authorize that service in order for it to be reimbursed. So same thing, Beth. I see this look of surprise on your face. I'd be happy to forward you that actual publication the emergency physicians got from Magellan. All that coupled together just feels like this is a complete cost shift to the physician that's providing the care, and that these changes are on the back of the physicians, and that the promises that were sold to us that managed care would bring actual increases in physician payment, especially specialty physicians, is not come true. And in fact, then what has been done with the fraud and abuse money that they promised? I think it was 9%. That they promised would be saved, and we would like the focus to be back on reinvesting that money in the physicians that provide the care and access to the Medicaid recipients.
Thank you. Steve Grigas also indicated he may wish to speak.
I actually had a big question mark on that.
Okay, thank you. Those were all the people who are in the room who registered to speak. I think Mr. Senior wanted to respond to a couple of the comments before we go to the phones.
Well, those are the people that said they wanted to speak in writing. Are there any additional people in the room that maybe didn't sign up on the sign-in sheet saying they wanted to speak who'd like to speak now? All right. Yes, Eli Nortelis. Go ahead.
Is that it? Am I on? All right. Sorry about it. Thank you. Eli Nortelis with Ackerman, representing Pediatric Healthcare Alliance and Lakeside Pediatric. First of all, I want to thank Justin, Josh, and the rest of the ACA team. I think throughout this whole process, you guys have been forthcoming and met with us, answer all the questions we might have, and again, took positive feedback from us. My question is more along the train of thought. Has the agency, or has there been any thought allowing the providers come up with the choices opposed to the plans, and that's what we kind of want to get to the heart of. In addition to that, we will be providing that in writing as well. That's why I wanted to kind of steer our questions towards.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wishes to speak at this time?
Just to respond to some of the comments, and we certainly welcome everyone getting their comments in writing. We will record all of the things and the questions that come into us, and we'll try to come up with a frequently asked questions document that allows you to get the answers that you need. As we get more and more questions in, we'll see some that are repeatedly answered or repeatedly asked, and try to get those answers out to you. In terms of the savings of the program, it's important to understand that the first 5% of the savings is identified in the statute, and it goes straight to the taxpayers. It was a 5% reduction in the per member per month cost of the program that we negotiated in the competitive procurement. As we do this, the statute does direct that the physician reimbursement rates, which are going to be increased, that they be done out of savings and not through additional appropriations. And so that's kind of what that's how we're trying to implement the statute. We do anticipate that more and more of these physicians and these physician groups that we've identified, more and more of them will earn this bump. And our intention is that the plans will realize more and more savings over time, and more physician groups will be folded into the program. We also recognize, however, and we do talk with the plans, and our actuaries talk with the plans, that a lot of physicians and physician types, depending on where they are in the state and what their specialty is, earn significantly higher than the Medicaid fee-for-service fee schedule already. And so dictating that for specialists gave us a little bit of pause without understanding whether the Medicare rate for certain specialists might actually be a rate reduction. So we are looking at that, and we do anticipate and do want all physician types to have a reasonable opportunity to get this bump, but we do intend to implement it out of savings. And with that, I think we can turn it over to the folks on the phone.
Great. Operator, do we have anyone on the phone who wishes to speak?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask an audio question, simply press star 1 on your phone. Immediately record your name, followed by the pound or hash key once again. If you would like to ask an audio question, simply press star 1 on your phone. Immediately record your name, followed by the pound or hash key. Your first question comes from the line of...
Name not recorded.
Questioner, your microphone is active. Please proceed. Questioner, your microphone is active. Please proceed. Your next question comes from the line of...
Mary, Sun Life.
Please proceed.
Well, folks, it's not so much a question, but observations. And that is the one party that's absent in these town meetings, and that as far as not being addressed in a very realistic way, are your patients' parents calling from a pediatrician office. Those people who don't have any skin in the game, so to speak, are parents. And in three areas that I can see that there would be significant savings if done correctly by the plans and supported by ACA, and also supporting the pediatricians, are abuse of the ER services, which is very expensive, circumcisions, which are done after the baby boy is born, and then if the circumcision is done, they have to see us, then we have to refer them to a specialist. The specialist sends us a report. They go have a circumcision in the hospital. Costs more money. I don't understand why a circ, if a parent requested, cannot be done in the nursery by the OB or an on-staff pediatrician, and that would cut out several hundred dollars right then and there for each baby boy if the parent wants the circumcision. Abuse of the ER is outrageous. We have had patients that we are open every day. We take same-day sick appointments, and yet we get reports from the ERs of patients who are seen the same time that we are open. There's no skin in the game for the parents as far as, well, if you go to the ER and it is an unnecessary, basically it's not an emergency, but a cold in many cases, then you need to pay a consequence. And that would, along with education, would provide the parent then a choice to say, okay, I'm going to continue to do go to the ER as opposed to seeing my PCP, okay, and suffer the consequence, or I'm going to go to see my PCP. And there's also urgent after hour care of pediatricians, that they're open. Urgent cares are open for pediatric patients when the pediatrician is closed, which is still a lot more cheaper than going to the ER. And the other area is regarding therapies, whether it's for speech, physical, or occupational. That needs, in my opinion, should be, the parent needs to be more involved with providing what is needed in the home as opposed to continued services that can go on and on for a year, 2 years. Is the parent really involved? Is the parent spending time in the session with the patient during the therapy? Is the parent learning these skills in order to be a support to their child? I don't think so. So in certain areas, such as these three right now that I just mentioned, those would be three significant areas of savings that everyone can enjoy. And the winner would be also the patient, which is the child, which we all want to make sure that they get their best services now as opposed to when they become adults, because then it's going to even be more expensive for everybody. So is basically my little soapbox.
Thank you.
So that's basically something to present, to mull over, and if these areas, as well as some others, are not addressed, any plan that's implemented is still going to fail, because it has to date with the extraordinary expense of medical care, in this case, for children who are our future. And that's all I'm going to say. Thank you.
We appreciate your comments.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you would like to ask an audio question, simply press *1 on your phone. Immediately record your name, followed by the pound or hash key.
Operator, while we wait for others on the phone, we'll go ahead and go to our members here, and then I'll come back to you on the phone once our members have had the chance to talk. Dr. Thacker, I think, had actually signed up to speak, so if you want to start, and then we can take other members as they...
Sure. Thank you very much. For those of you who aren't aware, I've been on this committee since its inception, and I practice as an internist but also certified in hospice care. I am a medical director for skilled nursing facilities, and so participate in a lot of these issues as an internist who also does hospital care. So certainly I'm a Medicaid provider. I represent the Florida Osteopathic Medical Association and also am a member of the Florida Medical Association. So I mostly have questions, and we might go down, you know, page by page, but I'll start out with just a little bit of a statement in terms of the overall concept of trying to save money in order to redistribute that, which I'm certainly not against. So one of the traditional problems that will surface periodically from a provider's standpoint is that providers for many years, at different times with different insurance third-party payers, is that they feel like, well, why are we trying to balance the budget on the back of the providers and that sort of thing? But if it's not the providers, then it can be the facilities, such as the hospital or the nursing home, or third-party payer can look at their pharmacy formulary. And so it creates an atmosphere of we've got to rob Peter to pay Paul. So I don't want, as a provider, I don't want to participate in any kind of system that works like that, because we're all on the same team. We all work together, and our goal should always be in the end for the patient, good quality outcomes. And you guys feel the same way. I've been with you on this committee for years, and I know you do, and I'm sincere about that. But it's also, I think, incumbent on us and ACA to make sure that everybody else is pulling in the same direction and feels the same way, and I realize that can be pretty hard. What I would not like to see the mistake made, because I have participated on the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee for the state in the past, for a couple of years I sat on that board, and I would not want to see the mistake of a company or insurance provider go through and say, well, we need to come up with some savings so that we can give the docs a couple more bucks per visit. So let's cut our formulary and let's take off certain medications because they're a little bit expensive. Or let's stop providing a brand name medication that provides a definitive therapeutic benefit or somebody's been stable for a number of years, in particular psychotropics and anti-seizure medications and that sort of thing, HIV meds, whatever it is. So let's make sure that we're watching for that sort of behavior, because that serves no purpose, and I don't want the $2 if we have to change somebody's therapeutic medical regimen. The other thing that we ought to be aware of and watch for is to make sure that at the end of the year with these different plans, that multi-million dollar bonuses are not being paid out to CEOs and other administrators. I would be resentful of that. I think that would be bad PR for everyone involved. And so I don't know what type of way to monitor that, and whether that's publicly presented or anything, but I think that would be a horrible PR result for everyone, including us. So now we'll try to go through with just a few questions, and if they're simple, we can take them as they come. But if I were to start on this slide presentation, page six. So we're talking a lot about payment at Medicare rates. So what is my question would be, what is the current percentage of payment based on Medicare that the average provider, is receiving? And is there a difference between the average provider versus the OBGYN provider versus the pediatrician? And my understanding that there is a significant difference in those three groups. My next question would be, if we go to page seven, I would agree with what our previous speakers had pointed out, where we have the pediatricians and OBGYN. And I would agree that subset of physicians we're talking about, that's a little bit too small of a subset. And we may have to divide this up and divide and conquer. I understand that. But that's a pretty small subset. I would at least think that we need to try to build in some kind of incentive based on the awareness that we already have of where we are thinnest in medical providers. So there are certain areas of the state, and in particular certain specialties, where you can't hardly get someone in, and that would be such as orthopedics or even dentistry. So if we want to, broaden this area, and if we can't handle all of the providers, then we need to next look at it. To add anybody to this list are the people where we're currently the most underserved or have the most problems with access. Page eight, is there a difference when we talk about pediatricians? is there a difference, or will the, you know, and I don't want to split hairs, but I can see exactly where hairs will get split and payments will be held up when we try to define, well, a pediatrician, is that different than a pediatric cardiologist? Is that different than a pediatric radiologist? Is that different than a board certified, duly board certified internal medicine / pediatrician? And how are they listed? And you know, what is their co-ID registered with CMS and registered with Medicaid? I don't know, okay? But I think we need to at least have an answer for that. Secondarily, OBGYNs, what if someone is listed on your rolls as an OBGYN but hasn't delivered a baby in several years because now they have a GYN practice? Does that make a difference? And so how will you tease that out, and how will the insurance people tease it out? And when they provide ACA, those types of statistics, how will you be able to, or we as a committee, how will we be able to discern who's really delivering babies? Okay, because if you got OBGYN, what we're talking about here mostly, you know, is the kids, right? So at least we need to make sure that we have a mechanism that teases these people out. Next page, page 9. So I would want us to be aware of that, and I had previously worked at a federally qualified health center myself. I started out in Madison. And I was National Health Service Corps physician. So I know what the issues here are. And I got to tell you, I had to moonlight a little bit too, okay? So what happens if you have your physician that, and I understand why FQHC, you know, we're not qualified under this. I agree with that. I understand the payment system. But what if that person, that physician, lists that, yes, this is his primary employment, however, they also do a little moonlighting on the weekends, okay, and they pick some other time up. How do you identify that physician, that provider, and will they then, in the different capacity that they're functioning under, would they be reimbursed differently, or would they qualify? Possibly not with the medical home model and that sort of thing, but we need to have an answer to those questions, which are going to come in. On page... and I'm sorry, page 13, I believe it is. I wrote over it. Page 13. So if someone has a discrepancy or a concern, what is going to be the appeals process? Who's going to mediate this? Okay? And you know that someone is going to say, listen, my Medicaid C-section rate was 36%. You know, maybe they missed it by two deliveries, and maybe it was, you know, oh, well, they've got the numbers wrong, or, you know, well, this it started out as a, you know, vaginal standard delivery and something happened, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I could see where someone would have some contention, and so what is the process, who that goes through, and what is the appeals process, the mediation process, and that needs to be clear, I think. And I'm sure that the providers will do that, but we need to have an understanding what that process is and ultimately where does the buck stop and what's the time frame to do that. Same page, 35%. I just wanted to understand that a little bit better, and Justin, you did a great job of going through this. I was just, but I might have missed how we came up with the 35% number. Is that truly arbitrary? I know it's not, but... You know, what is the number based on? But we have to be sure is when we talk about ratcheting it down, you know, we can't be arbitrary on that. So there's got to be some kind of real numbers and some type of precedent, you know, and you're going to have to say, well, you know, in, you know, Central America, the numbers here and whatever. I mean, we're going to have to come up with some type of number and how that works.
Dr. Thacker, just give you an idea. That is the current Florida Medicaid C-section rate. It's 35%.
Okay, good. And perfect. Okay, so then if we come up with a new number, we can't just say, well, I'd love to see 20%. Well, of course we would. Okay, but can we come out with the 20% number and say, well, nobody else is ever doing 20%? You see, so we just want to make sure that we don't look like that's arbitrary, because then we set goals that possibly will never be achieved. We just have to, you know, this committee has to talk, you know, reasonably about that sort of thing. Then on page 15, where we have talk about payment structures. So payment structures to providers, for a lot of folks that may not realize, but there's different components to the payment structure to providers in their own office, and especially those with a medical home model, because they want to try to provide, you know, one-stop shop as much as they can. There are many Medicaid providers, particularly in South Florida, that have their own ultrasound machine, and they have x-rays. They provide perform minor surgical procedures. And so these types of payments are, there could be types of payments labeled as technical fees. Right, so they do a chest x-ray. There's a technical fee for the cost of the x-ray itself, the person who performed the x-ray, the film, the developing, that has a certain cost and has a certain value in terms of reimbursement. But then somebody's got to look at the film and interpret it. That's a second fee, right? So we need to understand, when we're talking about the reimbursements, that okay, the physician may get a Medicare rate for interpreting the film, but they lose money by doing the film because they don't get reimbursed for the cost of the materials and the and how to perform that that particular service. We need to understand what reimbursements would be in terms of vaccines. I assume that's probably average wholesale price. But is there some small percentage above and beyond for the management of these vaccines, okay? Vaccines have to be purchased. They have to be stored. They have to be drawn up and then given by some personnel. All of that costs money to provide that. Then there are other concepts such as carve-outs or what we would call billabugs. This would be in terms of such as myself as a primary care physician, where I might say, well, listen, I can remove this skin lesion and biopsy it. I don't want to send you to a dermatologist who's most likely going to be difficult to find access for, going to have to wait, and it's going to be more expensive to the system. Let me do that particular service, okay? And so we want to make sure that certain things are not, when appropriate, are carved out, quote-unquote, from a plan, and at least have the providers have the ability to negotiate that to where they are providing certain services within their scope of practice that actually saves the plan plenty of money, okay? And that should be part of our plan, you know, when we're talking about an alternative plan, you know, if they select ACA's alternative plan, there should be some language and understanding of what a carve-out is or a bill above. And I know that was a lot. I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Thacker. And I think if you go online, you'll see that there is a lot of this detail in the technical documents that we have sent to the plans to get them specifications. Obviously, for the purposes of this meeting, we kept it kind of broad, but there's a lot more detail of that nature online. Mr. Whitaker, you are next.
Thank you. This is Dan Whitaker with the Florida Association of Nurse Practitioners. I just have a couple of questions, really. The first one is this incentive. Is it going to be across the board, rural, metropolitan? Every provider gets paid the same percentage if they qualify?
By every provider?
The providers that qualify for this incentive, if there's a rural provider versus someone that's in a metropolitan area, will that be the same, or will there be a discrepancy?
The only discrepancy will be what the Medicare rate is.
Right.
Okay. The Medicare rate is slightly different in Miami versus Fort Lauderdale versus what's called the rest of Florida. So welcome to the rest of Florida, everybody. If you're a rural provider in the rest of Florida, or you're a rural provider in Orlando, or you're a metropolitan provider in the rest of Florida like Orlando, it's going to be the same Medicare rate.
Okay. The other thing was in our rural areas, a lot of our OB also do primary care, both, so they actually are like dual role, I think it kind of goes back to what Dr. Thacker was mentioning, is that they do provide both roles. Is there a way that they're going to be recognized for the two roles that they play?
OB practices have two ways to qualify. They can be a patient-centered medical home recognized by one of the three bodies that we mentioned in the PowerPoint, or they can meet the three quality scores or three quality metrics that we listed for OB. So they actually have two ways to qualify.
Right, but if they have a half-and-half practice, so, you know, where they're doing primary care and OB both, are they going to have the ability to meet these HEDIS scores?
I'm not sure I'm following that. Maybe we could follow up with you on that one.
Get that one in writing. Again, we're here for a listening session, so we're going to try to take as many questions as we can.
And that's my question.
Yeah.
Okay. The other is the medical homes model. The ones that qualify for medical homes, are only the physician-driven medical homes going to be reimbursed?
So for pediatricians, the way that they can qualify is being certified as a patient-centered medical home.
Well, we have ARMP practices who are patient-centered medical homes.
Yeah. So this
and
is for
my understanding
only
is it's
law.
Physician only.
Right. Yes.
So I just want a clarification for that.
Yeah. Under the law, it's only physicians.
So when we look at patient-centered medical homes, we might want to qualify that. Thank you.
Crystal Stickle from the Florida Hospital Association, you're recognized.
Once the plans develop their policies and procedures about how they'll implement this, will that be posted somewhere on the agency's website so that if there are edits to that, that the physicians will be aware of where to find those edits?
Yeah.
And then will, after the original sort of program is developed, as each plan builds it out, if there are changes to the policy or the qualifications, or let's say they ratchet down their C-section rate, if that's something they choose, will that be updated in a place that's easily accessible for the providers?
We will have communication. There will be a communication strategy that will be required with this. The providers need to know exactly what they need to do in order to receive this bump. If they aren't going to get it as of October the 1st, they need to know the steps they can take in order to get it from the following spring going forward. And so there's going to be communications. Any tweaks to the plans, any changes to the plans obviously need to be accompanied by a communication strategy that lets providers know exactly what's happening and exactly how they can keep receiving these bumps.
And once the initial plan is set, if there are changes made by the plans, is that something that once you've approved the original, if there are changes, you're going to have to continue to get agency approval? There won't just be a policy notification that they're going to do something different as of, you know, October 1?
Correct. We'd have to have an understanding of what the changes are and what the implications would be for the providers.
Thank you.
Dr. Moffitt, you are recognized.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you for the summary of this as well. If I look at the Florida statutory requirement, it's, and by the way, it's Kathy Moffitt from representing the Florida Association of Health Plans, that the MMA plans are to coordinate care and manage chronic disease and prevent the need for more costly care. And my question is around obstetrics and gynecology. Having practiced in the state of Florida for about 20 years, I'm extremely aware of how hard it is sometimes to keep obstetricians in clinical practice. And since Medicaid is responsible for the delivery of 136,000 babies a year, it certainly seems important that they would be selected out as a group to incentivize here. During the procurements of the plans for MMA, I know we talked about the importance that you all placed and we placed on improving birth outcomes. And as a member of the Medical Care Advisory Committee, one of the limitations that we all face, and I know you've acknowledged, is that women do not remain Medicaid eligible sometimes in between pregnancies. And so improving interconception care, which then goes on to impact care during the next delivery, can be very, very difficult and challenging. And I think you've done a good job here at selecting out measures that capture that window of time where the woman can be captured during the pregnancy by the plan and by the provider, and she can be monitored for her prenatal care and for the quality of her delivery. I would wonder if maybe we could add to this elective delivery before 38 weeks. I don't know if you thought about that or not. And also postpartum care, but trying to impact her care in some way that will stick with her and make a difference in terms of interconception care, I think is something that the data really suggests is one of the most important things that we could do for these Floridians. It's everything here is very impactful. Prenatal care, getting that postpartum check, trying to control the C-section rate is, but trying to impact interconception care also is. And if we can't keep her continuously enrolled, at least trying to do something additionally while she is enrolled would be an improvement.
You're preaching to the choir here. Can I respond?
Sure.
So I think one thing to keep in mind that the physician compensation is one tool of many that we have. It is not the only tool that we have to incentivize quality health care. We have a lot of things in the contracts that the plans are all striving on their performance measures and so forth. But particularly, Dr. Moffitt, to these issues about interconception care, we have a couple other projects that we're working on. One has to do with promoting the use of long-acting reversible contraceptions, which is being recognized as a best practice so that women can, space their babies in such a way to have the healthiest outcomes and to plan their pregnancies. And we're working with a group out of Jacksonville, hospitals, health plans, and physician groups, and other stakeholders in that area, Healthy Start coalitions, to get more uptake of long-acting reversible contraception in the hospital when the woman gives birth, so that while you have that woman and you have her in care, that you can make an impact on the future for her. In terms of early elective deliveries, we've been working on that. We actually have a revision to policy coming out that makes it much, much clearer that is not medically acceptable, and it's not medically necessary, and therefore not covered by Medicaid. So early elective deliveries are not covered. They have not been, but the new policy statement hopefully will make that much clearer. So having a rate of any is not acceptable because we wouldn't accept it. And then last, I would just say we're working with our Healthy Start coalitions to reform the way that they approach things, and we're working with them to see if they can put more emphasis on that interconception period when women are not in Medicaid. That's somewhere where they may be able to reach them where we can't. So we are working on a number of initiatives. If this interests any of you, come see me, because this is something we're very focused on.
Any additional comments or questions from the members of the committee?
Okay, we'll go back to the phones then. Operator, is there anyone on the phone who has additional comments for the group?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask an audio question, simply press star 1 on your phone and immediately record your name, followed by the pound key. Your first question comes from the line of
Kent Robertson.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity that you guys have given us by giving us a call-in number for this important call. Two comments, two concerns. One, in speaking to the medical director and the other rheumatologist person that spoke a little bit earlier concerning the specialties, it doesn't sound from it doesn't look like what I've read or what I'm hearing on the phone that ACA is limiting the amount of reimbursement to those specialties, and in those rural areas where there aren't many pediatric orthopedics, pediatricians, or other pediatric subspecialties, the MMA insurance or health plans will have the opportunity of negotiating a higher rate in order to get those physicians in network, and that'll give those specialists the opportunity of receiving more money if they're not included in this quote-unquote bump that the primary cares are getting. Second, my concern is the incentive plans that would be developed by the various MMA plans that are participating in this. As you guys mentioned earlier, there can be anywhere from 2 to 4 to 5 health plans in any given region. And this will create a pretty good obstacle if each of these plans develop their own idea of an incentive plan that these physicians have to meet. And I think it'll make it extremely hard for them to keep up with that. And once again, that will just go to the expense back to those pediatricians in increasing staff, increasing their costs in order just to get the additional money to break even. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. And can you tell us who you're representing?
Partners Medical Billing. We do billing for several pediatric and pediatric subspecialists throughout the state.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for your comments.
Thank you again for your question. Your next question comes from the lineup.
This is Dr. Carola Fleener, Sarasota Children's Clinic in Sarasota, Florida. I've carefully listened. Hello? This is Dr. Fleener. What I've heard during the course of Mr. Senior's presentation, it became clearer and clearer that I think we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Because ACA made a very large change from when they established the parity payment 2 years ago. It was to all primary care providers providing medical care to Medicaid patients, which our practice has done for over 25 years. We have, day in and day out, provided medical care to some 15,000 patients per year, year after year. Now, I'm not board-certified pediatrician. I'm a board-certified family practice person. So, where does that leave me? I think I just got fired. So, I doubt that the MMAs are very motivated to include other provider types because that will just increase their expense. So I think that you all are about to lose a lot of older physicians such as myself because 30 years ago, 35 years ago, people were not getting board certified so quickly as they are. Everybody's board certified now. So ACA did make a change. They went from PCPs providing medical care to Medicaid patients to now saying only pediatric board certified physicians. And that excludes a lot of family practice docs who do provide medical care to Medicaid patients. My practice is 85% Medicaid, and that's all we do. And we provide concierge level service to these patients. I'm embarrassed to say that what I heard today is very painful to my practice and will cause us to lose a substantial amount of income. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Your next question comes from the line of
Mary Sunlight.
Please proceed.
It's basically a question again. There's a lot of, I couldn't hear too well from the audience when the audience was speaking. I could hear better when callers were speaking. Is there a way that this is going to be offered as a recording, or at least the highlights of you know, what was presented by the audience available in, you know, in writing for you know, providers to get a hold of to read?
There will be an audio file on the ACA website under the Medical Care Advisory page.
Okay, great. Thank you.
There are no further questions at the moment.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that is wishing to speak after some contemplation? Okay. Any other members of the committee? Operator, if there's anyone else on the phone, we'll give it one last try, and then I think we'll close.
There are no questions at the moment.
Okay.
Okay, with that, I will go ahead and adjourn the meeting.
Then we have some additional business.
Oh, do we? I'm sorry. Oh, it's not on the agenda. Okay, sorry.
Are we not going to go to it?
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your patience. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a great day.
Okay.
we can adjourn then.
Let's adjourn. We've got a schedule here. The next meeting for the Medical Care Advisory Committee is tentatively scheduled for July 19th, 2016. We hope to provide you some updates on this particular program as well as other regularly scheduled business for the committee. And with that, we will adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you.